The main character in Jeanine Basinger's new book about old Hollywood is not a particular star such as Clark Gable or Lana Turner, but the studio system itself. The star machine is presented as a being unto itself whose sole purpose was to create stars out of people who in real life you might not necessarily think were star material. The Star Machine is published by Knopf, and its author Jeanine Basinger is here to explain how the star machine worked and why it no longer does. Welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thanks, my pleasure.
We should maybe begin with the founding myth of Hollywood star making. Everyone knows, of course, that Lana Turner was discovered at Schwab's.
Except she was.
Except she wasn't.
But that's the myth then, you see. You're discovered where you weren't discovered, and it's turning yourself into somebody who was discovered somebody where you weren't that makes you a star.
All right, so let's pull that apart. What actually happened?
Well, she was a high school kid, not a particularly great student by anybody's admission, including her own. She liked to run across the street and have what she said would have been definitely not a soda, but a Coke, because she didn't have any money. And a Hollywood Reporter guy, Billy Wilkerson, saw her there and thought, this is a good-looking girl, and got her started. But where she was really discovered sitting on a soda stool was in a movie, They Won't Forget. And she was sitting on one. She was sipping a soda or a milkshake or whatever. And, you know, that's where we found her, and we're the ones who count, the public.
What you end up parsing in your book, it's a very sort of detailed anatomy of how stars were made. And I want you to start with some of that. You know, for example, star school.
Well, you know, they brought raw material in, and they might be educated. They might not be educated. They might know how to sing and dance. They might not know how to sing and dance. They might have a nose that would look good on film. They might not have a nose that looked good on film. So they brought them in, looked them over, and taught them and gave them the training they needed. And the training was very complete. It included acting lessons, which some people may question, but it did. It included—
Question, what do you mean?
Well, many people feel that a lot of the old stars were not necessarily actors.
Right.
Obviously, some were, some weren't. But generally, when that's said, people are applying a standard of acting technique that is more associated with theater, where on film, you know, acting is a little bit of a different experience. It's something where we need to be drawn in by them and just like looking at them and believe them as the entity they're playing, and then they repeat that entity over and over, which is a form of acting. It's just different from theater. But they gave them the training they needed, the teaching, the lessons, the how to walk, how to sit, how to give an interview, you know, how to hit your marks, how to feel the heat of the light, how to keep your eyes from burning out under the Kleegs. I mean, they basically taught them how to act in movies.
So these are techniques.
Yes.
But basically they were looking for it, what we call today it.
Well, we can call it whatever we want. It, of course, being Eleanor Glenn's great one, which, as somebody said, Eleanor had a good idea. She just forgot to put the SH in front of it. But the thing about it, star factor, the unknown quality, the X, whatever, something undefinable that separated this person out, that made the viewer in the audience feel a connection, to feel a physical reality to that person, to believe they knew what they were thinking, but at the very least to believe they were who they were playing on the screen in some form.
Mm-hmm. So how much was Lana Turner emblematic of how the star machine made stars?
She's kind of a typical example of star development. Of course, she's untypical in that she did become a superstar and was exceptionally beautiful and didn't need a lot of fixing up. I mean, no one had to fix her teeth or, you know, her body or do anything to her. But she was typical in that she started as a very young, uneducated girl, was protected by Mervyn LeRoy, who did right by her, developing her, brought over to MGM with her, and put through a system where she played small roles, bigger roles, bigger roles in more and more important films. And then when she hit it, the publicity machine went to work on her.
She then was known as the Queen of the Nightclubs. Her story sounds familiar to people who read Gawker.com today.
Yes, I think she would fit in very nicely. In fact, you know, she may be the grandmother or the role model for the Britneys and God help us of today. But the thing is, Lana Turner was always very professional. She was the queen of the nightclub. She was a young girl full of energy, pizzazz, and she liked to dance. She liked to have fun, and she could do it. She could go, stay out, and still show up, hitting her marks, knowing her lines. She was never unprofessional. And in the old days in the studio system, if you were, they had to really get rid of you. I mean, they were tougher. They were tougher about things. It was a business. It was like if you had a job and you didn't show up for work, you'd get fired, right? Well, they didn't get fired, but they sort of got demoted, shoved down, punished, whatever.
Mm. Now, one of the ideas in your book is that the star system then is very different from celebrity as we know it today. And yet we see this parallel with Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton. What's different?
The star system is both the same and different. It's the same in that we chase after certain entities. The publicity machine likes them. People want to read about them. We still seem to want them. Although everybody's telling us stars are dead, we're still reading about them.
Who says that?
Well, some people in the business do say that.
You mean in the old mold? Stars the
yeah,
way they
well,
used to
what
be.
They're talking about is you don't need a star to open a movie. You don't build vehicles necessarily, but you know I'm not sure that's true
that
either.
Seems completely untrue.
I agree with you, but that's the old system. They were protected from. See, today we can get very tired of a star because we have so much of them. Plus, for them to work magic on us is a little bit hard because if they're idiots, we can see they're idiots. If they're dancing naked at a nightclub, we see the pictures. If they have feet of clay, we see those feet
right.
on the cover
that
of people.
That never happened before.
Well, they protected them more. It was, first of all, Hollywood was a small town. They got up, they went to work, they went home, they worked 6 days a week. Publicity about them was controlled and shaped. And so if they had foibles, it leaked out, it was known, but it was a controlled system for them. And so the difference was they were protected, they had everything done for them, they made less money, they were owned by the studio. Today, they make a lot of money, they have their freedom, they're not owned, but they're not protected. So it's a trade-off.
Mm. And yet there is a certain degree to which publicists control information today even more than they did then.
Who's controlling information today?
Well, just in terms of access to celebrities.
Access is one thing. Information is another. I would say we know, God, I wish they would control some information. I would pay $5 for that. And, you know, I'd even pay $25 for that. But, you know, nowadays there is so much publicity and so many different outlets for it. I mean, and it comes to us in our home in every possible way. In the old days, you had to go out of your house, buy a movie magazine. Newspapers covered stars, but not the way they do today.
Right.
So it's a different situation.
Mm-hmm. The way you describe it, it seems to me that being a star back then kind of ruined your life.
It ruined some people's lives, not others. I interviewed stars about this. For some people, it did ruin their lives. It was too much for them. They couldn't develop or grow as individuals. When they didn't last, they didn't know what to do with themselves. They didn't learn to make decisions, write checks, cook eggs, do anything. On the other hand, for some people, it was a beautiful life. They were protected. They made money. They loved the work. They found love and friendship, and their stardom lasted so that in their old age, they were still warmed by the love of their fans. So it's an individual thing. You can't just give a blanket statement.
The Star Machine by Janine Basinger is published by Knopf. She is here with us today talking about the automaton that churned out star after star, and as you said, some were destroyed by it. Who?
A great case in point would be Gail Russell, a really beautiful, ethereally beautiful young woman who was brought into film because of her beauty. She didn't have a lot of acting talent. She didn't have experience or background. The acting in front of cameras frightened her. She wasn't comfortable. She didn't feel secure. She became a truly hopeless alcoholic, could never overcome it, and died tragically at a very young age. I mean, I consider her a great example of what stardom could do to you.
Mm. In more vague terms, maybe, mm-hmm. the distinction between one's identity and persona, one's self versus one's roles, mm-hmm. was blurred to the point mm-hmm. where people sometimes didn't know who they were anymore.
Yes, I love vague terms, so I can go with this. Yes, it's true. Imagine that if you became famous for portraying a character who was allegedly you at an age so young that you had no opportunity to find out who you were. That process that everybody goes through of having to sort of find out who you are and honestly learn to be true to yourself about it, they didn't get that opportunity. And when they received applause for playing the character they were supposed to be, it's very, very hard not to start being the character that you were supposed to be. It's the famous remark given over to Rita Hayworth, who said, sadly, tragically, some version of this, I've heard a lot of different, every man I know fell in love with Gilda and woke up with me. And, you know, there you have it right there.
Henry Fonda was asked by Billy Wilder to play himself in which movie was it?
He was offered a role that Billy Wilder, that he did not take, and Fedora. And Henry Fonda said, I couldn't possibly play myself. I don't know how, you know, to be myself. I can only be this character, Henry Fonda.
That has to have been exaggeration.
I don't know exactly if it is or not, because, you know, everybody gets a public persona who is in the business, and Fonda was known to be a shy kind of retiring man who had his own demons. And of course, on film, that isn't how he seems to us at all, really. But of course, he could play Henry Fonda. He was Henry Fonda, just as John Wayne was John Wayne in some way. They don't get to be that persona character unless something in themselves lends itself to it.
And yet some people sort of thrive on the idea of being given a persona that they can become, because perhaps there's not so much of a self there.
Well, you know, that would be part of acting, isn't it? I guess one of the reasons people like to be actors is you're given a role to play, and that makes it easier for you. Many actors and actresses talk about that. I'm most comfortable playing the role I'm given because then I know who I am. So for the Hollywood stars of that day, they were given one key role so they could keep it up and play it off screen nicely.
Would Clark Gable fit into that category?
Clark Gable definitely did fit into that. One of the interesting things about Clark Gable is he was given, you know, they gave stars questionnaires, you know, what do you like? What would you like to be? What about yourself? Because for one thing, they didn't want any publicity surprises. If the uncle was in prison, they wanted to say his uncle on a long vacation, whatever. But he talked about wanting to be like the men he had grown up among in Ohio. You know, hunters, fishers, and they created for him a persona that fit with that, and he really did learn to be that. Ava Gardner said that if you met him off screen, he wasn't like that at all. If you said, "Hiya, Clark," he was stumped for an answer, whereas in film, he always had an answer.
Mm. So what was the de Havilland decision, and how much did it play a role in the downfall of the system you described?
The de Havilland decision, which is Olivia de Havilland, she was the actress who managed to finally break the studio's contract system. If you signed a studio contract, you were under contract for 7 unbreakable years, and they basically owned you for that time. If you fought them over a role and said you wouldn't do it, they put you on suspension, and the time you were suspended was added to the end of your contract. So a 7-year contract could stretch to 9 or 10. People tried.
It's indentured servitude.
Yes, exactly. People tried to fight that, among them Betty Davis, who didn't make it. She fought it but wasn't tough enough and came back and gave up. But de Havilland was tough enough. She won the case. The decision is known to her credit as the de Havilland decision. It stopped that process. Contributing to the downfall of the studio system, yes, I would say it was a little bit of a factor, but there were many other bigger factors that contributed to the downfall of the studio system.
Do you see a particular moment when it happened, when it was all over?
It started in 1948 with the Paramount decrees when studios had to divest themselves of their theaters and their block booking practices. And then it started going downhill from there with, you know, an influx of foreign films, creating new audiences, television, HUAC, all kinds of issues. It's a very complicated process. But then the development of Stars really shifted over to television in a way. Although they didn't groom them in quite the same way, they did do star grooming.
Oh, really? Some lesser version of what you write about?
Yeah, to a degree they did, because Universal Studios had its famous school that Clint Eastwood and Burt Reynolds went to, and they were going to be movie stars, but they also, you know, if they could use them anywhere, they would.
I wonder if you think celebrity has changed fundamentally, or are the themes that you outline in this book intrinsic to the whole problem?
Celebrity and stardom are two different things. Stardom is similar. Celebrity has just gotten more and more insane. It's interesting that in talking about stars, which is what I'm talking about, you as a young person,
Thank you for saying so.
are using celebrity. What has happened to stardom today is it's become celebrity. And so
Very quickly, just define the difference between the two before we have to go.
Celebrity is famous for being famous and just for being out there being publicized. Stardom, of course, is actually doing something, actually reaching people in a performance or in a role. Being a star is something. Being a celebrity is something else.
We do have stars today.
We certainly do.
They are, you're probably going to say, more often than not, actors in a way that the stars of yesteryear
were not. Yes, they have the opportunity to play different kinds of roles, to select their own roles and to vary what they're doing and try to not be just one thing. So they're in charge of their careers in that regard. So if they're good business people, they have good judgment, know how to evaluate scripts, they have an opportunity the old stars didn't have.
Janine Basinger is the author of The Star Machine. It is published by Knopf, and it's a fascinating and a very detailed look at how the stars were made way back when. And I want to thank you so much for being on the Leonard Lopate Show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.